Good afternoon. I first met Dan Gerber in New York City with Jim Harrison. I can't remember now why they were in town, my town, as I felt New York City to be in the late 60s and 70s. I think there was a poetry reading sponsored by the Academy of American Poets, perhaps at the Donnell Library. But we had all gone to one of those wonderful bistro-style French restaurants in the 50s near 8th Avenue, and that evening made me feel a kind of camaraderie with these Michigan poets long before I even dreamed that I would ever live in Michigan or become a Michigander. I actually met Dan in a different way, a literary way, around that time, reading his poems in the Sumac Press anthology of five poets called Five Blind Men. I'd found it on the bookshelves of Richard Hugo's house in Missoula, Montana. Dick Hugo had loaned me his house for one night when he was out of town, and I was there for poetry reading. I fell in love with the photo of the five poets, Jim Harrison, J.D. Reed, George Quasha, Charles Simic, and Dan Gerber. I pretended that I was in a movie with them all that night, and I wrote a poem entitled Film Called Five Blind Men, which I included in my collection, The Motorcycle Betrayal Poems, in 1972. It's odd how poetry creates such intimacy. Dan hasn't changed much since those days, though his poetry has grown and matured. Amazingly, he still occasionally races stock cars and continues to live his life with both literary seriousness and physical gusto. Whether he's bone fishing in the Florida Keys or building barns in Idaho, where he now lives part of each year with his beautiful wife, Debbie, or having dinner in Michigan with Judith Minty or Jim Harrison, two of the state's finest writers, he brings a kind of wholeness to his life and work. In one sense, Dan is different from most of us. He was born the heir to a great deal of money. Yes, I think he was the Gerber baby. But I know no one who has worked any harder than Dan, both at real jobs like teaching and being a stringer for Sports Illustrated, and the unreal job of making a coherent body of poetry and fiction. I am pleased to see him published along with one of my favorite American poets, Judith Minty, by the MSU Press. I believe the two of them represent the best of Michigan's poetry community. To his writing, Dan Gerber brings his intense yet gentle knowledge of the physical world. To his poems, he brings a kind of Zen-like acceptance of the world's responsibilities. As he says in the title poem from his book, Snow on the Backs of Animals. A man walks out on a night like this, and the darkness weighs down his arms. He forgets his purpose, stumbles, gives up whatever it was he wanted, and enters the bodies of his friends, growing deep and luminous. In the almost 30 years that I have known Dan Gerber, though we have never been anything but friendly acquaintances and colleagues, I have always felt this glow in him. I have admired his decency, his generosity, and felt this simple goodness in his poems. His long-term commitment to literature and to the life of serious writing is like the man in his poem, walking out into the snow at night, feeling his earthy connection with his friends, the animals. It is both deep and luminous. Dan Gerber.
Thank you so much for being here, and thank you, Diane, for that beautiful introduction. It's hard for me to think that was me, but... it's funny, hearing her talk about our meeting, I remember that very, very well. And I remember, I was telling a group this morning, I fell in love with Diane before I ever met her. I saw her on the Today Show sometime in the mid to late 60s, and she was reading a poem about George Washington, about the father of her country, and I was just knocked out by it. And She tells me now, though I'd completely forgotten it, and it speaks to how impressed I was by her, that Mario Andretti was on that same show with her, but I have no recollection of that at all. And I very well remember Diane's poem to the Five Blind Men, and I remember taking it to Jim Harrison. He was in the hospital in Traverse City. He had fallen down and injured his back, which was only the beginning of it, but they gave him penicillin, and he had an allergic reaction and almost died. But as he was recovering, this poem, which made us all feel, much grander than anything else that had happened to us in a long time, I aided in his recovery. The title of my new collection is Trying to Catch the Horses. And the horses are, of course, metaphorical horses, but also actual, as things metaphorical are. It's been my experience with horses, or come to think of it, with poems, sometimes that you have to come at them sideways. I was just thinking, this just came to mind, it was something Emily Dickinson said about telling the truth but telling it aslant. It's been my experience that if you're trying to catch a horse, it puts up a defense in the horse that makes him very interested in not being caught. But if you are a good actor, he may become curious. Trying to catch the horses. When I give up and turn my attention to the purr of the grass, the clatter of the aspen, the clouds lifting off Mount Tiwanat, I become a curious god, a tar baby, a clump of grass they must graze. I reach up and touch the blue with my fingers, not just the air above my head, but the sky itself, as far as it goes. The trees, the grass, the leaves, the river. I borrow a couple of lines from Rilke, preface this poem. The desire to be a creator, to give birth, is nothing without the thousandfold consent of things and animals. Would these things I came to praise be pleased if I read them my poems? Or would I feel foolish in their presence, reciting what I have made of their incomparable lives? If I came to this meadow to exalt them, would I clear my throat for their attention and then be unable to speak? Would I be wounded by the silence of the stones, the resolve of the river, not even pausing to listen? The falcon intent on a life in the air, the fox trotting off at the sound of my voice? Or would they be secretly pleased and reward me with their mute applause, simply being more what they are? Would the prairie dog come out of her den to scold me? The crane clack and wallop her articulate wings? The wind pick up and roar in the willows to absolve me in the chorus of their amplified song? I grew up in Michigan and actually lived here most of my life, although now I live in quite a different landscape in a place where the natives call Idaho, which is right on the Idaho-Wyoming border. I live in Idaho, but I look out on Wyoming. And when I lived in Michigan, trees were the predominating presence. You felt small because you were surrounded by big trees. Where I live now, space is the presence. Or you feel even smaller because you're just sort of absorbed and dissolved into all of this space. It's not so much comparable to living next to the ocean as it is living on the ocean. It's as if the land were the sea. I can look off to the west of where I live on certain conditions of light in the afternoon and see mountains that are 134 miles away. Sometimes I can watch three or four kinds of weather at the same time. But trees are a rare commodity in this landscape. And the first year I lived there, there was one very small, unprepossessing aspen tree that I developed a relationship with. A tree on the prairie in mid-October. Something about the single aspen I photographed a dozen times this fall, hidden from view in sage and grass, on the far slope of the hill I can see from my bedroom window. Of those who walked with me, no one took notice. I don't know why I am drawn to this gnome-like tree, the way its heart-shaped leaves enliven the sun, perhaps, a little more gold each day. Something not only of itself comes out of the tree when I see it, something not me, that I am. Our lives are short in the middle and long at both ends. How strange to give up being alone. A crow. I am walking on the earth, held down by the specifics of everything around me. Things circle, though I don't quite perceive them as moving. Except, of course, the crow making lazy swats at the moment through which he swims like a lumbering skate. He flaps on beyond the bend of the planet and or beyond the canyon's pine ridge where I can no longer see him and assume he is a prophet now living in Judea, preaching to a glade in Nineveh. A little influence from Yeats there at the end. Side effects. The moon keeps the earth on its course. I read that. Actually, it keeps the earth, unlike the other planets, from wobbling, so that we may have somewhat predictable seasons. Hence life as we've come to think of it. Steadying moon, who pulls me out to the lawn with her light, a kind of gravity that keeps the mad fly imprisoned by the lampshade, in spite of every effort I make to tell him he's free to fly away. Walking out alone. Have you ever doubted that the basement stairs go deeper than the basement? That the desire you ignore is desiring you? That plaintive look on the faces of dogs we take to express so much more longing than they probably ever intended. Beyond the meadow is a greater meadow, and beyond the trees, more trees. In the late winter sun, these hard little pebbles cast hard little shadows on the road. On my walk, I wonder if I am any less lonely than I ever was. Wildflowers, in this case, the yellow arrowroot, wait for me in the fields. The long-needled pine has secrets it will keep till the breeze rises, and the breeze has stories for the pine to translate. The roots of the sage almost trip me, and the marsh hawk swoops low to show me her bright wings. She forgets she has done this before. The fox on the hillside across the slim ravine watches to see where I might be going and what it is I might do. This doesn't concern her, except that everything concerns her and concerns me too. I suspect that she is always watching and almost never lonely. I hadn't planned to read this next poem, but I have to because I remember a comparative philosophy course that I had here where I first became introduced to Berkeley and Descartes. And it's called Cornhawks. Begins with a quote from Spinoza. The more we understand particular things, the more we understand God. This morning, three cornhawks, birds previously unknown this far west, or east for that matter. Descartes was not a bad man, only lacking the knowledge of these inconsolable birds. Just before the reading, I was having a conversation about dogs. And this poem was written by my dog. My dog collaborated in this poem in any case. It was a gift from my dog. I was, I thought I worked alone, but actually she's with me every day. She's 10 years old and she's trying to escape our year-old dog, I think. But I looked up one morning and I saw her across the room lying on the threshold of the door looking out and outside, and I noticed that her ears, quite independently of each other, were moving like signal flags, counting treasures. My dog lies on the threshold and her ears are never still. If I were deaf, I could read just watching them, flagged like velvet semaphores, saying breeze, rain, bees, laughter from next door. My dogs are named Willa and Eudora. After. I live 8 miles north of Driggs, Idaho, largest town in the county, population 800. The population of Driggs is 800, not the county, but the county's about 900. But I was in Driggs one day having a buffalo burger at Mike's Eats, and my eye was caught by something. At just a quick glance across the street, something quite beautiful caught my eye. I went to investigate. The bear on Main Street. What made the man kill this bear? His truck, across which the bear's body lies, tells me it wasn't to feed his family or because his children were cold. The bear has beautiful black feet, delicate, almost like the soles of patent leather slippers, and the wind riffles its fur with a sheen of water in the autumn sun. The bear looks as if it might only be sleeping, but its tongue lags from its mouth, and the man has wrapped it with stout twine and bound it to the bed of the truck, as if he were afraid it might speak. Three teenage boys pull their pickup to the curb. One of the boys guesses what the bear must weigh. Another wants to know how many shots it took. And the third boy climbs down. He strokes its nose and forehead. He traces the bear's no longer living skull with the living bones of his fingers and wonders by what impossible road he will come to his father's country. The river seen from above. I wrote a couple of lines from Jim Harrison to preface this poem. It's very difficult to look at the world and into your heart at the same time. We see the man walking toward the edge, the thin crust he doesn't see. A spring day in midwinter, he and we can feel the returning heat of the sun, smell the loam so long frozen, the fresh basil from memory, expecting the twirr of a blackbird with each step. How cruel to come in so close to the end of this beautiful movie. How cruel to see this direction and be unable to change it. This abundant life so near its conclusion. our conclusion, though perhaps not his. Diane mentioned that, you know, my love of fishing and bonefish and tarpon and other kinds of fish I like to fly fish for in the Florida Keys. I discovered an island in the South Pacific that's supposed to have the best bone fishing in the world, a place called Christmas Island. And I planned a fishing trip there with my son, who is also an avid fisherman. And so we met in Chicago and we flew to Honolulu. And when we got to Honolulu, we were told the trip had been canceled because the plane that flew from Honolulu to Christmas Island had been grounded. And so we never got to Christmas Island. But I discovered that the neighboring island to Christmas Island is an island called Tarawa, where a famous battle was fought during the Second World War. And it occurred to me that the reefs surrounding Tarawa were probably also populated with those same bonefish that I love to fish for. Now, the invasion of Tarawa was sort of a disaster because the Marines were put ashore, but it was bad timing. They went ashore at low tide, and the landing craft ran aground on the reefs 1,000 yards offshore, and they had to wade in over all that that distance under very heavy Japanese fire. Also, another thing that contributes to this poem is I had just had knee surgery, and I was in a great deal of pain when I wrote this, as you'll see. But Pablo Neruda wrote about the invasion of those same islands, and he said they did not hear the singing of the reefs long enough, and perhaps never touched the islands, those wreaths of brilliance and perfume, except to die. This is a story about what happened in 43. There are 20,027 stories like this, about the hit I took through the knee on the way in, wading over the long reef, about the color of the water around me, how it blended with bits of coral and blood from other knees, like a great soup stored up from leftovers, how the frightened bonefish, trapped by the tide, shot through our legs. We never thought of fish in the sea, and how this was their home, though not their war, and not ours either, though we were swimming in it. I've spent a fair amount of time in Africa on various journalistic assignments. One was covering a last great safaris. And while I had grown up hunting pheasants and ducks with my father, I had never shot a big animal. And we were living off the land for a month while we were out there, and we needed camp meat one night. So I decided that I would go out and shoot an antelope and skin it and dress it and just to see what that was all about. So, but it was going to be a once in a lifetime thing for me. It was a big deal, you know, and I went out and boy, within 5 minutes, the most beautiful male impala you ever saw just presented himself and just said, shoot me, you know. Well, the Swahili word for the male of the herd is dume. And I got the impala in my sights, and then I couldn't shoot it. I just lowered the rifle and told my friend Bill, the professional hunter, I said, this is too easy. This is a once-in-a-lifetime thing. There's got to be more to it than that. You know, I had some sort of Western idea of sportsmanship. However, it did not please our tracker, a Wandorobo man named Lombot, to whom this poem is dedicated, and he became very angry. And this poem is a bit about that experience and the wonderful thing that Lombot had to say. We needed meat for the camp, and never having killed anything big, I wanted to know what it meant to skin and clean a life and to eat it to stay alive. But this death would have been too easy. This beautiful impala, this dume, who presented himself in the first half hour as though it had all been arranged. I eased the rifle down. This wasn't what I thought it would be, I told Bill. I would only do this once, and there had to be more to it than this. But in our tracker's black face, a black rage was growing. "You go back to America," he said. "You take pictures." This dume would have been dinner for us all. "He doesn't want to kill something like an impala, something beautiful," Bill tried to explain. "He wants to kill something ugly like a warthog." The tracker drew himself up like a cobra and looked off toward the afternoon hills. "Beautiful," he said, as if a word to learn. "Beautiful or ugly, the heart is one." Under the great sky. A letter in the hold of a 757 leaps over 600 million hours of being, a simultaneous eon, to say, "I love you," or "please sign the enclosed and return." The postman steps out of the elevator and through the revolving door. The letter is read and reread, then pressed in the leaves of a book. Or maybe it's returned. Here's a little poem I've never read aloud. Inspired, I think, from a few lines by the Spanish poet Juan Ramón Jiménez, who is a favorite of mine. It's only four lines. "Calm Spring Hours," it's called. "These calm spring hours make us homesick for what we haven't lost. Or is this what love is? The drone of an airplane hidden by clouds." Although I live out west now, I still see that landscape through the eyes that I got here. I'm still a Michigan boy, Michigan poet, as Diane said, these strange exotic creatures she met in her town at Bistro. This one definitely came from my life here a long time ago. It's called "The Cool Earth." It's noontime on a summer day, sometime around 1948. Boxcars are standing on the tracks, doors open, waiting for the rest of their loads. But it's noontime now, and the lift truck drivers are resting. Hay bales stretch out over half the field. The farmhands are resting under the large maple along the fence line, their shirts wet from the morning's hauling. And with the light breeze, there in the shade, the rough cotton feels cold against their backs and ribs. I come home hot from play. My mother has made me an egg salad sandwich, and the screen door whaps on its spring. Our dog is resting on the cool earth of the foxhole he's scooped out against the foundation of the house. My father stops to speak to him before he comes in. My father groans as he imagines he would groan if he were the dog stretching there to his greeting, stiff-legged on the cool black earth in the shadow of the kitchen roof. He carries the jacket of his seersucker suit on his arm and the morning's mail in his hand. There is a knowing beyond, but not apart from this. I hear the braying of the spring as it stretches, though there is no slap, as my father eases the door shut behind him. He kisses my mother and drops the mail on the counter. "It's hot," he says, but he clearly enjoys it. He's as happy as I am that it's a hot summer day in our little town, and that it's noontime, sometime around 1948. This inspires me to go back and read one poem from an earlier collection called 1948 in Chicago, in 1948 in Chicago. And it comes from two things. It comes from a story my father told me of something that happened to him in Chicago, probably in the 1920s, but I wasn't around in the 20s, so I've transposed it. And also coming from the experience of my daughter having told me that she hated me. Now, I don't remember whether it was something I told her she had to do or something she couldn't do, but it really didn't matter. In 1948 in Chicago, my father swerved to miss a paper boy, turned the wrong way up a one-way street, and got nailed by the cop on the corner. He never had a chance to explain, and it wouldn't have made any difference. Maybe the cop had been pondering a nightmare, his wife moaning under the dance instructor two floors down, or his daughter threatening to leave home if she couldn't go up to Wisconsin for the weekend with the defensive backfield and a couple of other friends. It isn't easy being a father. I realize that now. The long, silent burns I caused, those looks of resentment, ways I had of putting the guilt on him. Maybe we're all that way. And he was thinking about that when the newsboy stepped off the curb to sell a paper, never intending to dart into the street. "Where are you from, anyway?" the cop yelled back after the lecture, after telling him to beat it. "Fremont," my father shouted, feeling his small town pride as he said it, certain the cops in Fremont were never thus blind. "I thought so." The cop heaved his shoulders and turned away in disgust. In every thought I've had since he died, my father has forgiven me. I wondered where 1948 came from. I mean, I think I have a couple of other times it pops up, and I figured it out. I remembered probably sometime early in that year standing at the top of the basement stairs in my parents' home, red linoleum stairs, looking down the stairs, and having this thought and thinking, I'm 7 years old, and I'm never, ever going to be 7 years old again. It was that first intimation of mortality that, you know, that life does go on and we do change. Spirit harness. This begins with two lines from a favorite poet of mine named Takahashi, a Japanese poet. And he says, well, I'll just read his lines and then the poem because it all goes together. It is a long black bridge, so long that to cross it is unthinkable. But before I set foot on it, I realize I am already on the other side. Though I can never cross it, the bridge is there like a finger pointing at the moon, though the finger itself gives off no light. Psalm. All my dead are with me. All my dead are at ease, free of time and what never may be. All my dead are at peace with each other. They will never change their minds. They forgive me whatever I feel needs forgiveness, and blame me whatever I think needs blame. They are sunlight come to comfort me. They lead me on the trail of my life's work. In my hand, I see my father's hand holding this pen. My mother's eyes, finally free of longing, gaze at me in the mirror. When I stand, they look up to see where I'm going. They can't see far through the tall grass, but they see the tall grass, and they smile to see it moving behind me. Just before he died. My father told me that all he would miss was that Hungarian stew my mother was cooking the evening I took him to the hospital. Years have passed now, my mother dead for a decade. I wonder if he really did miss that pungent stew. I wonder if he still does. I wonder if she brought it in a golden bowl, or if he turned as a child turns to other things, like that first glimpse of mountains driving west. Actually, the last thing my father said to me was that all he was going to miss was that spaghetti sauce that my mother was cooking. But she did make a very good Hungarian stew, too, and it scanned better than spaghetti sauce. And I can't resist. I can't. But I remember thinking that I hope I had that good an exit line. But I had a friend who shared his father's last words with me several years later. His father was very elderly in the hospital. The nurse kept trying to put an oxygen mask on it, and he kept refusing. And finally, she gave a deep sigh and said, "Well, Mr. Rosenbaum, are you comfortable?" And he said, "I make a living." It has occurred to me how I am made entirely of things not me. I mean, I'm not made of a billion little pieces of someone named Dan Gerber. I'm made of a billion little pieces of things that have all come together and for a very short time in the scheme of things have taken on an identity that for want of anything better people call, you know, by that name. Same for you. Dust. This crumbling brick has no fear of death, doesn't know if it's coming or going. Particles compressed make a brick, make the brick, like me, an assemblage. Speck of dust, who are you? Never again will I shake out the rag, determined to be rid of you once and for all. Where have you been, my love? And where will I see you tomorrow? Quite by chance, I find myself by a lake where I discover my divorced wife, long dead now, spent her summers as a child, long before I knew her name. I loved that little girl I never knew. I must have, because I later loved the woman those summers became. I must still love her in some way, or why does this knowing become such sweet pain? Something I think I want to tell the little girl, who of course has been well warned not to speak to strangers. A face at the window. I borrow from Rilke to preface this poem again. What they want of me is that I gently remove the appearance of injustice about their death, which at times slightly hinders their souls from proceeding onward. Old sorrows that lurk around the house, feeling for a crack in the siding, are like a fire we think has gone cold, the ashes ground into embers, but the embers still glow. They wait in the dark till we're distracted, then slip in around a casement where we've let the caulking go. We sit them down at our table without thinking. We warm them with our desires. We tell them our favorite stories and urge them to drink our best wine. We embrace them, and they whisper the names that have wronged us. We feel them breathe in our ear and grow dizzy with their love of injustice. They form to our bodies like worn leather, till we hardly sense them at all, only that the night has grown thicker and the lamplight strains at the bulb. I think of Orpheus coming out of that darkness with nothing but tears to show for his travail, that what we still long for longs to be let go, like that fleeting but unmistakable flavor in the air just before it starts to rain. My father came back from the First World War when he was still 19 years old. He was assigned to a French infantry regiment as a scout, and he was awarded the Croix de Guerre by the French, which was a fact that he forgot to tell his parents, and they read it in the paper months later. Which is to say, my father never talked about the war very much. He did tell me he felt terribly betrayed after the war. he felt lost. I thought of the lost generation in that, but he had that kind of lost feeling, and that feeling that if the combatants had been allowed to settle the war, the settlement would have been more just than that made by the politicians. He said, we didn't hate those guys. He said, you know, they'd been through the same thing that we had. But apart from telling me, maybe recalling sometime something somebody said at Soissons or Chateau Theory, as he called it, he never told me much about the war. But he did tell me, the one thing he did tell me was that the one vision he couldn't get out of his head, the one image was just the fields and fields covered with dead horses. And after he died, I found his diary, the diary he kept during the war. And years later, I took it and went to France and followed it around and tried to think what it might have been like. And years after that, wrote this poem in which I tried to reimagine my father's experience. My father's fields. September 1918. They looked like blackbirds, my father said. That first burst of shrapnel, spiraling up in autumn flight. And at first, that's what he thought they were, their glossy wings catching the sun as they wheeled in the morning sky. There was that moment of beauty, the glint of it in that first day on the Meuse-Argonne, before the earth came off its perch, as if they had offended it somehow. Or that's the thought he had, he said, the earth rising up over every stored transgression. And what had they done to bring this on? Later, it was all the dead horses, the field before the river strewn with horses, and his friend, Carl Johnson, sleeping off the numbness of battle, at peace almost, but for the way his leg wrapped up behind him, and the too wide smile of the bloody mouth across his neck. Carl playing dead among the horses, he thought, of Carl with his Belgians at the county fair. 90,000 horses moving up the roads at night. He had never imagined so many horses in the history of the world, or so many men in their silent march, imagining no longer the September morning as they looked out on the manicured stubble of the burnt gold fields and the still green trees in the haze along the river. These few things he noted in his journal, though he spoke to me only of the horses, the things people said, and the newly shorn fields. The trees along the river are what I see when I think my father's thoughts, not the fiery sky, the tangled wire, the splintered forest, or all the dead horses, but those fields shorn of wheat, as his father's fields would be in September. I'm going to read one more poem from the book and then one or two newer poems. Where I live now is open range land. And what that means is that animals have the right of way. And you're not required to put up fences to fence your stock in. However, it's suggested that you put up fences if you want to keep other people's stock out. But some mornings we've woken up with as many as 40 horses around the house. I remember one day last summer, two horses sprawled out asleep on the lawn. Later in the day, they were in the garage having a look around and then looking in the kitchen window, and they just hung out and visited us for a couple of days and then moved on. This poem is called Wild Horses. Out my window, wild horses. Or they aren't really wild. They are my neighbor's horses wandering over the unfenced fields. They are wild to me. They touch something long before minoxidil and the World Wide Web. To see you naked is to see the earth swept clean of horses, but not really. Swept clean for horses, maybe. My neighbor's daughter rolls down the car window to ask if I have seen her horses. One of them is black and white. Something in me wants her to ask me to saddle up and help her corral them, to ride down the scree slopes of canyons, to come into a wild country where the centaur still lives, to ride together till the hills run away. I tell her I saw them move off over Teton Ridge, southeast. Good luck, I tell her. She backs on the shoulder and waves as she turns toward home. Wild horses, one of them a paint with a black fiddlehead. I look back over my shoulder. I can smell the riders coming. I wait for them on the ridge above the coulee. I will let them come closer to almost believe they can catch me. I'm going to conclude by reading three poems written since I finished the manuscript of To Catch the Horses. Some months ago, I got a letter from my friend Jim Harrison in which he said, "It's interesting watching your poems take their shape, i.e., once walking in the dim light of a swamp, I saw a deer on the other side. But then it took flight as a sandhill crane." What he was saying, more or less, was that my poems often turn out quite differently than they seem at first. From the first draft of the poem, the finished poem may be almost something almost completely different. This is called "The Journey of This Short Poem to the World." I begin by laying the keel of what I think might be a great ship, already imagining a year-long voyage to the Happy Isles or a summer cruise on the Caspian Sea. But by the time I'm ready to set the main ribs, I realize it's actually the fuselage of a small plane, poised and revving for flight. And even before the wings are welded in place, I look down through broken clouds on high mountain meadows, succulent green pastures no one has lain down in, except maybe the Anasazi. This morning, talking about how poetry began for me at about the age of 12 by reading a poem and having it make me feel a way I hadn't felt before, and not feeling at that time, you know, not having any conscious thought that, you know, I wanted to be a poet, but feeling at that time some need to put words together in some way to make myself feel in some way the mystery that reading this poem had. And this was a time not too long after the Second World War, which formed most of my childhood memories. I grew up three blocks from a German prisoner of war camp, and VJ Day was my first clear historical memory. But this poem is called "On Being Sent Away to School." When they called me to the office to tell me my grandfather was dead, when Herbie Schellenberger, ex-corporal of the Third Reich, who seemed old to a classroom of 12-year-old boys, and told us with ill-suppressed laughter how funny things were in the war, how his lieutenant, having failed in his duty at Bastogne, put the water-filled barrel of a Luger in his mouth, and how silly he looked with his head reduced to the size of a saucepan, ridicule the sentimentality of my missing so much Latin because an old man was dead, and how that first poem, "The Highwayman" by Alfred Noyes, was my ticket to a light less harsh, where a beautiful woman gave her life for love, and how a mist I might not have otherwise seen rose from the first frost on the grass where the sun beat down through the autumn morning as I carried my suitcase out to catch the bus that would take me on that long ride back to where a month ago I was a child. This final poem is called "Water and Light." As I told an audience the other night, I was in Lansing about a week ago for a bookseller's convention, and when I checked into my hotel room, I walked over and I looked out the window, and there, right across the street, in big neon letters, water and light. You know, it was like they're making a production of this. You know? And then I took a step to the right and saw that it said Board of Water and Light. But poets live by such things. Water and light. Ah, sunflower, weary of time, that countest the steps of the sun, William Blake. This life has to be more than a preparation to die with tranquility and pain. Keeping the worst before you always, a litany of deceit and horrors, on the premise of facing what's real. A fool's paradise, you say, mistrusting all forms of delight. If I had the choice of a lignum vitae cross on my back or a lucky coin in my pocket, a cinder in my eye or the image of a lovely woman, though the woman may be churlish and the supply of cinders unending, that beautiful bird in the hemlock or the soot on the window between. I am always returning to the edge of a lake, to water lapping at the loam of a bank under pine needles, slapping at the bellies of dock planks, or looking into one of those still black ponds, like a limpid pupil of the planet, through which it watches the other stars, and even our own silent faces, gazing down to its intensified heart. My dog, endlessly licking herself, drives me mad, as the woman I once loved was mad, while I took on her madness to love her. I thought I felt a tremor this morning as I looked from the kitchen window, uncertain whether it was the earth or an accumulation of me. Then the robin I was watching froze on the lawn, and from the bedroom, my wife called, "Did you feel that?" And if lightning chooses and allows us no time to decline the honor or accept it, the honor to be finally ourselves no more, a flash in the summer clouds. How much the feeling a poem makes is like the feeling after making love. No one here but the morning breeze. I walk out pushing my way through the pine boughs, yet remain at my desk, watching from the window your shadow joyfully parting the air, like a woman with pale blue veins in her breast. When I pause to wonder if I'll see you again, an amulet carried all my life comes up missing. Every moment that won't come again, a thousand stars made by sun and wind on the water of the lake where I stood and gazed among poplars before returning to the house no longer there and the woman no longer alive, but clear to me now and even more deeply than at the moment I remember, when I may have been dreaming of light on the water of the Trevi Fountain in Rome when I was 18, in mind of light on the waves of Lake Michigan, where my 7-year-old feet made tracks in the sand toward the water where all the tracks dissolve, and the stars return with sunlight and memory as the breeze rises. I imagine a man alone in space, never to see the earth again, except as a beautiful light. In the canyon this morning, I imagined my life a cup dipped out of the river, this discreet, imperfect water I need to keep flowing. Thank you very much.